So I'd like to welcome everybody to the live podcast that we do every month. This is the American Psychological Association's Division 50, or the Society of Addiction. We are so fortunate today to have John Kelly. Dr. Kelly, I would like to think of you as a friend besides a colleague. It has always been a pleasure getting to spend time with you, hearing your thoughts about things like this and many other things. But today you will be talking about talking dirty. By that, what's meant is talking to people and about people and relating who they are to their habits or addictive behaviors, and how to do that smartly and how to do that not so smartly. So, Dr. Kelly, would you please just further introduce yourself, and you can start right in. I have quite a list of questions because I'm really interested in this great topic.
Great. Thanks, Bruce. No, it's great to be here. Thanks for the invitation. And hi, everybody. Thanks for spending time this afternoon on this topic. And I hope it's, you know, I hope it's informative and interesting and useful in your work. I think it's a topic that is very important in our field, given the stigma. I mean, it's such a stigmatized area of medicine and psychiatry that I think we need to be thoughtful about how we talk about it, how we conceptualize it. And as Bruce mentioned, you know, the idea of, you know, talking dirty, it's a play on words, obviously, in terms of how we describe individuals with dirty urines. That's where it really comes from. When we talk about being clean or dirty, having a dirty urine or a clean urine. And this is common clinical vernacular. I mean, this kind of language is used in clinical settings, but we wouldn't use that kind of language with any other health condition, but the way that we do with addiction. And so it kind of really, you know, it kind of focuses our attention, purposely use that to focus our attention on this whole issue of language and terminology and stigma in our field. And it's something that I actually, you know, have gradually, I wasn't always interested in this, but I have become interested in it really in the last 10 or so years, just as I've come to realize and appreciate how our language actually, you know, triggers and concepts and words, of course, and language is fascinating to me now. I mean, it's just more fascinating since I've been looking in this area, just what language actually is and does in terms of how we perceive the world and how our language frames and reflects our approaches to different things and how we view things, particularly, I think, with these very stigmatized health conditions that has very high relevance. Now, Bruce, are we going to kind of have questions as we go? Is this kind of a discussion?
What has happened in the past is that each of our guests has done just exactly what you did. You started out by explaining your interest and giving us some background, and mm-hmm. at any point in time, you can break and say, "Are there any questions?" So we have a really good group who will ask questions, and but what, you know, typically what a guest talks about is interesting enough that even if you didn't stop for questions, it would hold their attention very well. So I leave it up to you. One of the things you haven't done is to describe where you're at and specifically your university, the hospital that you spend the most time in uh-huh. Boston. And stuff like that, just so we have kind of a context.
Okay, yeah. So I'm a clinical psychologist and clinical researcher. Most of my time is spent in research, has been for the last, you know, 15 years, most of my career, actually. I am at in the psychiatry department at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And so there, I conduct research. I'm kind of a person who writes grants, you know, hopefully gets grants, writes papers. I do a lot of talks. I do supervision, clinical supervision. I oversee a clinical program And I run a recovery research institute, which is intended to actually address these issues of stigma in part to do with addiction by translating and synthesizing and disseminating the science on treatment and recovery for addiction. So I do kind of broad spectrum, you know, kind of clinical research, clinical and teaching, as well as supervision. I've become more interested over the years also, and it kind of this ties into this other interest, which is in policy. So I'm interested in policy because I think policy also, you know, hopefully good science can inform policy, and it's been a natural progression, the evolution in my own career, to kind of, you know, move more towards the policy end of things, or at least have become very interested in policy, to look how we can influence public health through our policy-making decisions. And I'm hoping that, you know, every researcher's hope is that our science can influence policy so that we can have positive effects on public health.
Very nice. See, that I think oftentimes people will be listening to a guest and they won't really have the perspective of what that person's been doing, and your extensive and broad experiences I think really matter when it comes to talking about a topic like this. So you know, you have the big study of 500 people who you sought to find out what they thought about people in two different vignettes. Is that the one that you kind of started with back in 2010?
Yeah. Well, that's certainly the first empirical study that I had done on this specific area.
Would you talk about that? It's such a simple, basic, straightforward, and smart little study.
Yeah. No, I mean, it is a simple idea. I became curious and interested in this topic of how language can affect perceptions of an illness like addiction, and whether people might view it more punitively or as more compassionately, in terms of, you know, instead of punishing people, maybe people need treatment. And of course, this pertains, of course, to our language, the terms that we use, because our terms and our language really reflect and also influence our approaches to different, you know, social problems, or in this case, clinical problems, disorders. And of course, it also relates to whether we actually even view substance use and related disorders as criminal problems or public health problems and clinical problems. And when you think about our terms we have in the field, we have all kinds of terms, right? We talk about it as addiction, we talk about it as substance use, as substance use disorders, as substance abuse, substance abuse disorders, harmful use, hazardous use. There's all these different terms that are used in our field to describe the nature of these problems, the kinds of harms and hazards that are caused, as well as individuals with them. And it can be confusing. I guess the first thing that disturbed me was the lack of precision in the terms that we use. This is separate from the stigma, but it relates to stigma, I think, overlaps with stigma, because we sometimes use words generically to describe the field overall, and sometimes our generic use of the term is confused with technical specificity of the kinds of terms that we might use, for example, with a diagnostic label. So, for example, you know, we often talk about the field, or historically have talked about the field of substance abuse, and talk about substance abuse or a person abusing a substance or a substance abuser. Sometimes that's used to describe someone who actually meets criteria, or under the old criteria for DSM, which was substance abuse. So that was actually a diagnostic label, but it was also used as a generic term to describe a whole range of problems. And this is where it can get tricky in terms of really discriminating. Is that person really referring to the abuse, the disorder, or the field in general, the whole spectrum range of problems? So this can create, and I've reviewed just at random scientific articles, which even in the same article use abuse, for example, as a diagnostic label, but also in generic terms. So this is where it can become very confusing as to what we're talking about. And this relates to, you know, this issue of stigma, because obviously when we think about the old terminology that we had in DSM-IV, abuse was perceived to be not as severe as dependence. It was a separate subcategory of lesser problems, non-addicted use, more harmful, hazardous use with related consequences. But it's also, in terms of the word abuse, of course, has given rise to the word abuser. And the term abuser, like I said, I've been writing about this since 2004. Mark Keller, who's no longer with us, but he was a researcher in the alcohol field for many decades and an influential figure. He has written about this topic, and I've read several of his papers on this topic. And he influenced also the World Health Organization, and other people in the World Health Organization have been writing about this for a while. And back in the 1970s, when this initial biaxial formulation of addiction came out from Griffith Edwards, who talked about these two axes, one being dependence on one axis and then related problems on the other axis. So he talked about these two axes related to addiction, one being the syndrome itself and the other one being the related problems related to the syndrome. And this, the related problems really became the abuse criteria in DSM, DSM-3 and 3R initially, and the dependence syndrome became dependence. And now we've collapsed those, of course, in DSM-5 into one long category with, 11 symptoms, kind of put them all in the same category. I don't want to get into that now, but whether that's a good or bad thing, but that's what happened. Back in the 1970s, when this was all happening, the World Health Organization advocated against using the term abuse. Why did they do that? It's because they felt that it could give rise to the term abuser, which was a very stigmatized term and could, evoke ideas about being, similar to being a child abuser, so very stigmatized problems. So they advocated against it, but nevertheless, here in the U.S., it was adopted as the category term for lesser hazardous harmful use. Also, the National Institutes of Health, i.e. NIDA and NIAAA and SAMHSA as well, also adopted the term abuse in their titles. So now for a long time, this didn't bother me until it just came to bother me. And I became interested in it and what it might convey, particularly the term describing someone as a substance abuser, what that might give rise to. And this relates to this issue of stigma and discrimination. Now, when we look nationally and internationally at stigma and stigmatized conditions, what we find is that both domestically here in the U.S. as well as internationally, drug addiction and alcohol, alcohol addiction as well, so illicit and illicit drugs, tend to evoke highly stigmatizing attitudes. In fact, when the World Health Organization conducted a study of 18 of the most stigmatized conditions across 14 different societies, including drug addiction, alcohol addiction, as well as being a criminal, being HIV positive, etc. Many stigmatized conditions were in this list. What they found was that the top most stigmatized condition across these 18 different countries was drug addiction. Number four was alcohol addiction in this list of 18 different stigmatized conditions. So we are talking about very highly stigmatized conditions both nationally and internationally. What this does is that it delays treatment seeking and it increases the risk that people will drop out of treatment and also fail to stay in remission and in recovery because of the stigma and discrimination about being or having had a history. And there are certain things that we can do to try and minimize stigma and discrimination. And one of them, I think, is to think about how we actually describe individuals in these highly, who have these highly stigmatized problems. This led me to thinking about, well, what is stigma and what are the factors which influence stigma? And so when you think about, well, what are the factors that really influence stigma? One is cause, what caused the problem, and the other one is control, right? Can they control it? So, in other words, is it their fault and can they help it? So when you think about something like, some kind of genetic, purely genetic disease, or even something that's, an interaction of genetics and environment like cancer, you might say, well, yeah, we might have more compassion because you say, well, yeah, may have contributed it somewhat, but they didn't really cause the cancer, especially if it's more genetically determined. And they can't control it because, you can't use, your willpower to control cancer directly. And when you look at addiction, people will say, and the reason why I think it is so stigmatized is people look at it and will say, well, they did it to themselves, right, because they caused it, because they're the one that took the drug or the drink. And by the way, they can control it, and this is fueled, I think, by this broad spectrum of problems that we see related to alcohol and other drugs. And there is a broad spectrum of impairment related to that. In other words, we might see some people who have really radical impairments in terms of their ability to control, regulate the impulses to use. And other people can regulate it, even though they might meet criteria for the same disorder, addiction disorder. But they're able to maybe have greater control over it because they haven't lost that degree of ability to regulate those impulses. But we see, in other words, we see a broad spectrum. And even among very severely addicted individuals, there are times when the person is able to cut down or stop for a period of time, maybe very short in some cases. But the predictability of that ability to regulate is very unpredictable. And so this creates this kind of impression that, wait a minute, well, maybe they can control it and they have control, therefore they're engaging in willful misconduct. And so you can see how this can then fuel these two factors of cause and controllability, particularly with alcohol and drug use, that could lead to people feeling less empathetic or compassionate towards individuals with drug addiction. Even though we have learned, of course, in the last 20, 30 years, that about half the risk for addiction is conferred by genetics. And we also have learned that the action of substances on the brain produce profound changes in the function and structure of the brain, including necrosis that kills brain cells and can alter the shape and structure of the brain as well as alter its function quite radically and dramatically among those who are severely exposed to intoxicants over a long period of time. So we can see now, we used to see on autopsy that if you look at severe alcohol dependence, for example, that the brains of alcoholics weighed about one-third less from their age and gender-matched counterparts. So they've lost about one-third of their brain mass in relation to alcohol intoxication over many years. Now we can see this before autopsy, of course. We can see through MRI and fMRI scans how the brain structure and function can be radically changed and impaired. So when we think about cause and controllability, we know that addiction, like other illnesses, is a contribution, is a complex disease that is a function of both genetics and environment. And in terms of controllability, that the ability to control is on a spectrum, it's on a range, of impairment. And it can be, when you look at the functional structure of changes in the brain, you can see clearly how someone might be able, you know, have much lower ability to be able to regulate these impulses given the changes in the brain. And this helps explain what seems very puzzling from the outside, is how come you have an organism, a human being, a human organism with a propensity for growth and reproduction that ultimately destroys itself. It self-destructs through this malfunction by overdose or by poisoning itself to death prematurely through this malfunction that happens in the brain. And we can see that more clearly today and understand that more clearly. But clearly, you know, a lot of people don't know about what we have learned in our field itself, that we've seen these impairments and we understand them much more clearly. So I think when you know and understand about cause and controllability, you feel more compassion because we understand more fully exactly what the nature of these conditions are, and they help explain what seems like crazy behavior as people seem to be shooting themselves in the foot, ultimately destroying themselves in the process.
In your paper. The one that you published in the medicine journal, the American Journal of Medicine, it was kind of a summary of the studies. I thought that this point was so important, so I want to just make sure I get it. So to the extent that people see the individual with a substance use problem, to the extent that they see them as causing it, A, or not controlling it when they should, B, the extent that they see that, in that fashion, they will be more judgmental or they'll be more likely to stigmatize.
Yes.
Okay, because I think that's such a vital and interesting point. So, sorry to jump in. I just want to make sure that's really that's real clear and that I got that.
Absolutely, yeah. No, thank you. Yeah, no, it's good to underscore that, underline that, because those are the two elements I see as being major contributors to stigma related and discrimination related to these particular disorders. So,
can I just say one more thing? I'm very excited about the next thing I'm going to say. I didn't say this earlier, and I should have. Anyone who wants to follow along when you start to describe your 2010 study, it's actually posted on the Division 50 on our bullet, we call it a bulletin board. It's where we have everything from these live podcasts. So you can just go to cbtaddictions.org/D50 or Division 50, and then it's the first article, and all people have to do is click on where it says click here for Dr. Kelly's study. So, and that's the one that has the vignette and everything. So that's there for people who are interested.
Great. Thanks, Bruce. Yeah. So moving along here, I mean, you know, keeping that in mind, you know, how we might view individuals with these problems and in relation to these main drivers of stigma, cause, and controllability, there may be language, you know, the way that we have viewed it historically, related to that, that might increase or decrease stigma. This was my theory. And when we describe someone as a substance abuser versus someone having a substance use disorder, that might give rise to different mindsets or different connotations or different views regarding cause and controllability. So this is what I began to think about because substance abuser was so widely used in our field and still to some degree is used, although less, I'm happy to say. If you think about it, you know, what might that evoke if you describe someone as a substance abuser versus as that same person but describe them as having a substance use disorder? So this was the question I thought was worth kind of addressing, and as Bruce mentioned, what I did was to try and look at whether describing someone with each one of those two terms might give rise to different viewpoints regarding a greater need for punishment versus a greater need for treatment. My prediction was that describing someone as a substance abuser would give rise to more punitive attitudes and a lower likelihood that that person would need treatment. And describing someone as having a substance use disorder would do the opposite, would diminish a view that that person would need to be punished and be more likely to increase the idea that they would need treatment. So I did two studies. The first study I did was a randomized study where I took a vignette, as Bruce mentioned, and a simple vignette about someone involved in a drug court situation. So they were in the criminal justice system, in a drug court, and they were required as part of the conditions of probation to be abstinent, and they were monitored with urine, toxicology, et cetera, were involved in behavioral treatments. But they had relapsed, and they were up before the judge, and the judge was going to make a determination about what to do. And that was the story. That was the vignette, essentially. But in one of these vignettes, Mr. Williams, who was described in the vignette, was described as a substance abuser in half the vignettes. And in the other half of the vignettes, Mr. Williams was described as having a substance use disorder. So they're identical apart from that particular term. And then these were randomly assigned to 561 doctoral-level clinicians. So half of them got the one with Mr. Williams as a substance abuser, half got him described as having a substance use disorder. And then they were asked to read those vignettes, and then each vignette that they got, read that, and then answer questions relating to things like punishment, whether they thought they would, should Mr. Williams should be punished, or whether he should receive treatment, whether he was to blame for his condition, whether he caused it, whether he was safe, perceived to be safe.
John, let me just reiterate. I mean, I'm reading the instrument you guys created, and it's just a terrific stigma instrument. You know, if people click on that link on that website, that's a really substantial instrument that you guys created for this study, and I see that it's derived from another instrument. And again, it's quite good and quite interesting. It really taps into more than just a kind of stigma versus not stigma. These are really specific questions, like you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so we try to tap into cause and controllability and safety. I'm pretty sure we did a factor analysis.
Yes.
To derive the factors that were used ultimately in the scales, the subscales, which looked at treatment and punishment. So essentially what came out of that was very interesting to me was that when people at random were exposed to a term describing the exact same individual, when they were exposed to a certain term, they actually had a systematically different perception about that person. And specifically, when the person was described as an abuser, they had a more punitive, judgmental attitude towards that person than when they were described as having a substance use disorder. So what it seems to me then from that particular study, what it seemed to me to convey was that exposure, even when you're a doctoral level trained clinician, even addiction specialist, so very highly trained individuals, they were susceptible to a bias, an implicit cognitive bias that was induced by exposure to a certain term. In this case, describing that exact same person as a substance abuser versus having a substance use disorder. So what's interesting about that, and I think important, is that even though we're not aware of it, and even though we don't intend any prejudice or bias explicitly from using certain terms, when we use terms like abuser, we may actually be inducing implicit cognitive biases towards individuals who have these problems. And this led me to, and I did another study, this was not randomized, I was interested in doing a similar study in a general population sample, And what we found in that study, when we exposed people to these two terms, is that they were, again, more likely to view a person described as a substance abuser versus having a substance use disorder as more to blame for their problem, that they caused it themselves, and were more in need of punishment than treatment. And people described as having a substance use disorder in the general population sample were more likely to view that person as less likely to blame and more likely to need treatment. So this kind of, these studies kind of caught on. They went around the world in many different media outlets and news outlets and, scientific, academic areas as well, just because it was really the first experimental study which had looked at these terms and how it might affect our own judgments implicitly and unconsciously. Since then, what's happened in this specific area is that it's quite a lot, actually, because these two little studies, this one that Bruce mentioned in the International Journal of Drug Policy and the other one in the Journal of Drug Issues, has really had a big influence, actually, in terms of impacting our the way that we talk about addiction and people suffering from these problems, including I was very honored to be invited to speak at the first National Drug Policy Reform Summit to ever be held. It was held at the White House a couple of years ago, and I was asked to present this research there because what they wanted to do at this Drug Policy Reform Summit was to underscore a shift in our policy away from the war on drugs towards a broader public health approach. And moving away from describing individuals who have these problems as abusers toward describing them as having a substance use disorder fits with a broader public health approach as opposed to a criminal justice war on drugs approach. The other thing that has happened and I've been pushing for is to change our language overall, so to get rid of abuse and abuser completely out of our lexicon and move towards the idea of describing these problems as public health problems and clinical problems. And last September, I had the opportunity to present these data to the International Society of Addiction Journal editors in Budapest. So I went there and presented with my colleague, Richard Seitz, who's a strong advocate of these changes as well. And we presented to the International Society of Addiction Journal editors, and we were able to get a consensus statement approved that was universally adopted by the Society of Addiction Journal editors and is now published in these journals and online, that advocates strongly against the use of the term abuse and abuser. This means that when we're submitting to addiction journals, that it was strongly advised that we not to use abuse and abuser. So I think this is a good step in the right direction because it means that we won't be reading it. You know, we won't be reading it in our scientific literature because they won't be allowing it in there because of the potential implications in this very stigmatized field of ours.
John, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
That'd be terrific. I was wondering if the substance or the behavior that's problematic, gambling, smoking cigarettes, drinking, I wonder if there's a difference between the various addictions, because I was wondering if it matters whether we say, oh, he's a cigarette smoker or he's a drinker. I know that a term like he's a gambler certainly it has connotations that are not terribly positive, but, he's a heroin addict is some pretty strong language. He's a cigarette smoker for some reason just doesn't sound that bad. And I wonder if you have thoughts about that, the differences between the addictive behaviors and, why don't we start there?
Yeah, well, it seems to be, you know, overall, when you look at kind of a hierarchy of stigma, if you will, in our own field across these different substances, we go from more stigmatized problems being in the illicit drug world as opposed to the licit drug world. So we find, as that World Health Organization study found, if you were an illicit drug addict, as it were, you were more stigmatized than if you were a licit alcohol addict.
Ah, yeah. And so, how about a gambler? He's a gambler.
Yeah, yeah. Again, when we describe the person by the behavior, I mean, this is something that the mental health field has been way ahead of us on overall, as moving towards person-first language. So rather than describing someone as an alcoholic or a gambler or a gambling addict, describe them as an individual with a gambling problem or a gambling disorder instead of describing them as the condition, so as an alcoholic or an addict or a gambler. And so they've done this for a long time. They've really moved towards person-first language to help destigmatize and you know, reduce discrimination against individuals with these problems. And you notice, you know, when I talk about these problems, I always talk about them as individuals with these problems. And I've just kind of, you know, got into the habit of doing that. And of course, language is a habit. It's the way that we describe people. And if you look at our first cousins in the eating disorders world, people with eating-related problems are universally described as having an eating disorder, never as food abusers. And yet, we have adopted and gotten into the habit of describing people with addiction disorders or substance use disorders as substance abusers. And it's really just a habit. And we can get out of the habit. Sometimes it does mean that we have to, expand our use of words, because it's longer to describe someone as having an individual with a drug problem or individual with an alcohol or smoking or gambling problem, as opposed to a gambling addict, the shorthand. And I think there's a natural propensity, of course, for language to evolve and to develop terms which convey the same meaning, but in a more shorthand way, right? That's what we try and do. Language is a natural evolution of language towards greater efficiency in communication. But I think that should not occur at the expense of marginalized, discriminated against, and stigmatized populations like we have in our field. So even though we have to spend a few more words describing individuals with these problems, I think it's worth it if we want to have an impact overall in public health in treating these kinds of endemic problems.
Very good. I have more questions, but I'd really like to open it up. I know there are people who also have questions for you, so let me throw it out there. I know we have smart people with good questions on the line.
Hey, John. This is Noah Emery at the University of South Dakota. I have a question for you about this. I recently was talking to, at my university, we have an addiction studies program, and I was talking to them about this very issue, and they brought up a very interesting question, which is, how do individuals who are in the 12-step program who use language like introducing themselves at the very beginning of the meeting, like, my name is Noah and I'm an addict, how do we begin to shift that language and come up with more positive terms to even shift those biases that contain themselves within the mutual help groups?
Yeah, I think this is the next stage of that. I think, you know, when we look at social identity and the idea of self-labeling and self-owning, recognizing that one has an illness actually has a positive prognostic implication. So individuals who can acknowledge that they have an addiction disorder, those individuals tend to have better outcomes than people who don't. You know, I mean, you could argue this is classic, kind of the idea of denial or low problem recognition versus some problem recognition. And I think it's a step in the right direction that people are self-labeling. Yes, I do have this disorder, whatever the disorder may be, in this case addiction. In the same way, it's important to recognize that, yes, I do have cancer and I need to do something about it, and really facing that. So I think the next step, and this has been done, of course, nationally with messaging, the messaging that has been adopted through Faces and Voices of Recovery, for example. And some of you may know that the kind of language messaging that they use is, rather than saying, you know, I'm an addict or I'm an alcoholic, they're saying, I'm a person in long-term recovery.
Oh, I like that. I really like that. I hadn't heard that.
Yeah. And so I think that's really the next step in terms of moving away from, I think people, you know, in 12-step organizations, they understand what they mean when they say, I'm an alcoholic or I'm an addict. But from the outside, and this is where I think when Faces and Voices of Recovery came along over 10 years ago now and said, well, we need to change the stigma and discrimination around these health problems. So how do we do that? There are two ways. One way is through education about the nature, true nature of these conditions. The other is through kind of coming out of the closet, as it were, and realizing we have, you know, 20 to 40 million people in long-term recovery in the United States, but they're anonymous. You know, you don't know that they're your neighbors or colleagues or coworkers or even extended family members. You may not know them because they don't talk about it. So all we hear is all these negative, you know, things that are highlighted in the media regarding celebrity X has relapsed coming out of rehab or whatever, but we never hear about people getting 5, 10, 20, 30, 40 years of recovery. So in order to help, you know, break down those ideas, stereotypes in our society that people can and do achieve long-term recovery, they've adopted this stance of describing themselves as individuals in long-term recovery as opposed to being an alcoholic or an addict. So I think it's probably a shift that will be required. Whether that will occur in 12-step or other mutual health organizations, I don't know. It could eventually happen. But I think that will be the right way to go.
You know, I really like I like your entire answer, but there was one part of your answer in particular that that I will remember for a long time here. I've observed directly a whole lot of people with addictions saying, you know, it helps me to call myself an addict. It helps me to call myself a crack addict. And what you just said a while ago that I like is that, you know, recognition is such an important step that just the weight of recognition might be much greater than the concern about self-stigma. So to the extent that somebody prefers to label themselves as part of the recognition process, it could be that they are not recognizing the severity or the weight of their problem when they express it in delicate terms. I mean, and that's on an individual basis.
Right, yeah. Does and that I think, you know, people who have an addiction problem, they're already self-stigmatized. They already self-stigmatize and feel oftentimes terrible about what they are doing. I think it actually, when they actually do acknowledge that they have a problem and can admit it and acknowledge it, that's a liberating step, as you say, Bruce, you know, in terms of facing the problem, acknowledging it, and even if they call themselves an addict or an alcoholic or recognize that label, that diagnostic label or term or concept, then that can be a step, you know, into recovery. But then moving towards, you know, as I said, I think moving towards describing themselves as a person in long-term recovery, again, person-first language would be the next kind of wave or next wave of this movement towards destigmatization.
Wonderful. I'm going to ask for other questions. We have quite a number of people on the line, so I'm sure there'll be more questions. And we only have 15 minutes, so please jump in, anybody, and don't be afraid.
Hey, John, this is Lauren Hoffman. I'm just kind of curious. So one of the things that I think many of us might have difficulty with is trying not to be repetitive in our language when we're drafting manuscripts. And so, for example, if you use the term prescription drug misuse, and you don't want to use that term several times over and over again in the same sentence, you know, you kind of want to turn to prescription drug abuse. But do you think that it would be, I guess, in that context, wrong to use that term? And if so, what other synonyms might you suggest that we use?
I would say, again, stick to two principles. One is person-first language. So describing individuals with a certain problem, and then use any term other than abuse.
Right.
And again, the other problem there, of course, is scientific precision. So kind of thinking about, well, if I use this term, am I using it in a way that is scientifically and clinically precise, or am I using it in a generic way to describe a general the term more generally, and making sure that whatever term is used, that that's what people will understand by it.
And I think there was some sort of resource online when I was looking at your articles to draft the blog that gave other options, terms as other options to use
that
don't carry as much stigma. I forget exactly what it is, but that's something that we might be able to provide on our blog for other individuals to use as well.
Right, and I think it's maybe the Journal of Addiction Medicine. It was Richard Seitz's journal. He's now the editor. I think it might be the Journal of Addiction Medicine, which I think is the ASAM journal. It's the ASAM journal, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And on there, Richard has put up all kinds of alternative language to use and correct terms or preferred terms to use to stop you, you know, to get away from abuse and abuser principally.
Great, thank you.
Thank you for the question, Lauren. And Noah, thank you.
Other people with questions, so I don't hog the time.
I have a question for you, Dr. Kelly. My name is Jen. I'm a student, and
Hi, Jen. I
had a question about this as it relates to being a student and working in settings with interdisciplines, psychiatrists, nursing staff, occupational therapists. When I'm working with other providers who have more experience treating this population but are attached to the language, the outdated language that you're discussing, I find myself in an awkward position of feeling like me as a student with less experience wanting to educate someone with more experience about the impact of language. And do you have any recommendations for students kind of trying to create this cultural shift in language in their training environment?
Well, that's a great question. It's a difficult, I totally agree. And, you know, I too, Jen, you know, I'm in a situation oftentimes where I hear people using, you know, this kind of language, which can induce these implicit cognitive biases. And, you know, sometimes I feel like, well, what should I do here? Should I jump off, you know, like the language police and say, you know, you can't use that, you know, term. And here's why. It's challenging. And I think it will take time, as these things often do. It takes probably many years for these trends to change as we evolve, and people get word of what words not to use. But I think most people who work in our field, they don't want to use terms that would be stigmatizing, and especially now we've got actually some good data to suggest that some of these terms actually do induce implicit cognitive biases. So it's no longer a question of semantics or political correctness, but rather when people use these terms, they are potentially inducing these cognitive biases. And I don't think they want to do that. I don't think people working in our field want to increase stigma. And so It's trying to help them to become educated around these issues, because I think if they did know, they would say, oh, I didn't know that. I didn't realize that I was doing that. I want to try and get into the habit of not using that term now. That's been my experience and observation. And, you know, I mean, one of the things I think can be done, other than jumping up and jumping down their throat and telling them that they're wrong, is to, you know, find ways to subtly integrate it, maybe do a talk yourself on the topic, or introduce it, or have you seen this article? You know, this is really interesting. You know, more subtle ways of introducing the topic about language and terminology and how it might be influencing people inadvertently. So I guess I don't know the right answer to that, but there's some ideas, I think, in terms of helping us all kind of understand more about how language can shape our approaches and trying to find the best way really to do that. You know? Thanks for the question, Jen.
Thank you.
Who else? Well, let me ask a couple of questions, or maybe just one, in case somebody else has one after that. One of the things I'm wondering about, and it's a little bit off topic, but not really. I was delighted in May of 2013 when we all learned that DSM-5 had done away with abuse and dependence. But I was not really thinking about language then. I was more thinking about just the validity of the constructs. Perhaps including anything you want to say about language, just thoughts about using substance use disorders now in DSM from maybe both a validity and language standpoint versus those terms that are still so widely used, abuse, but also dependence. I think it's going to be just as hard to get rid of the term dependent as it is abuse. But anything you want to say on that transition from DSM-4 to DSM-5 from any perspective, from construct validity to language to whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm very happy that we got rid of the term abuse from DSM-4 and have really gotten that, eradicated that, and I'm happy that we've done that. I think it was more to do, I mean, I've spoken to the people involved in DSM-5. They were very aware of my research in this area, and that, you know, had that subcategory been maintained in DSM-5, they would have dropped the term abuse, even if it was maintained. They decided, of course, to use a single category and place all the criteria in the single category from 1 to 11. I think there's pluses and minuses to that in terms of the abuse. The abuse diagnosis was had a very poor reliability, as you say, and validity in terms of its criterion validity. And you know, when you look historically, of course, the reason why that was never really meant to be a subcategory, that was really the second axis of this biaxial formulation, with addiction on one axis or dependence on one axis, and the related problems on the other axis. So they were really related in the sense that as addiction increased, so did the related problems. And this is what Griffith Edwards had explicated in the original formulation in the 1970s. And unfortunately, that got placed into these two categories, with dependence being the addiction syndrome and then abuse being the related problems, where you have social impairment and hazardous use, driving while intoxicated. They're all the consequences, really, of heavy alcohol or other drug use. And then placing them in the single category was based on correlational data showing that with increasing rates of intensity of use, the abuse criteria tended to be at the higher end of the spectrum, along with many of the dependence criteria.
Right. That was the interesting thing. You can die just as easily from abuse as you can from dependence, and the assumption was that abuse is somehow dependence light.
Right. And I think the which totally makes sense when you look back at the original formulation, because the original formulation would have said exactly that, that as your addiction increases, the more these consequences increase. So you would see at higher rates of addiction severity, you would see more of these abuse criteria, as it were, because these are the consequences. So it made total sense from that standpoint that they were never meant to be discrete categories. Now, the problem I see with DSM-5 is the long list of symptoms. Now we have to have these specifiers for it to really make sense.
Mild, moderate, and severe, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you talk about someone with a substance use disorder now, what are we talking about? Someone with, you know, 8 symptoms is very different than someone with 2. And in order to specify, I thought the dependence construct, that did have high reliability, that did have high criterion validity. That was a useful construct, which is really now the moderate and severe subcategories within the single category of substance use disorder. So it's created a kind of a new problem in the sense of we've got this long, very heterogeneous, even more heterogeneous category with a whole bunch of people with varying degrees of severity in it. And without the subspecifiers, it's really hard to know what you're talking about. Because you could have someone with 11 symptoms or someone with 2, and they're in the same category. So we have to make sure that we're talking about in terms of the mild, moderate, severe. And I don't think there's this very strong empirical basis for these subcategories.
Very interesting. You know, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a problem because and we may find out, you know, that as more studies get done, what is the actual empirical relationship between someone who has a moderate, you know, in other words, 4 or 5 symptoms as opposed to 2 or 3 or 6 plus, and is 6 plus the right subcategorization, et cetera. We just don't know. I think these are empirical questions that we're not there yet, even though we've delineated these subcategories.
Yeah, that's interesting, because not only are we not there yet, but for years to come, we're still going to see publications that use the term abuse and dependence because the data was derived from the DSM-4 criteria, and you can't just make believe that you weren't studying the constructs that you actually were measuring at the time. I mean, we're still going to have studies that come out that are based on DSM-4.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Well, we're getting really close to 1 o'clock my time, which is near the end. I decided that I was going to write down kind of the theme of our conversation today. And what I wrote down, Dr. Kelly, is that it's bad to be a person who abuses language, but it's even worse to be a language abuser. How's that?
I like that.
Okay. Good. Well, I want to thank you on behalf of everybody who is on the call. At last check, it was close to 20. Could be more, could be less. And I'm quite certain that everybody enjoyed it. The little dinking sounds where people are getting on the line, and I'm sure enjoying this. We will post it on our cbtaddictions.org/D50 website, eventually moved over to our regular Division 50 website for all to hear. So, Dr. John Kelly, thank you again. It's been a delight. And I wish we had more time with you.
Thank you, Bruce. I really appreciate the opportunity. Thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And again, I'm sure the pleasure of everybody who got to listen. So take good care, and I will see you in the near future, I'm sure.
You bet. Take care.
Bye-bye.